More than half of the cost of a new build is now the cost of government. Even if we were to build entry-level houses, they would still be ridiculously overpriced. The housing crisis is government-made.
We're nowhere near the level of Charlie Kirk. Did it cross your mind at any point in time where it was like, man, maybe that can happen to you?
Yeah, and yes, I could end up in a situation where that becomes a real consideration. This is a spasm of violence as they lose their grip. They thought that the future was theirs. They are recognizing now that social shift that we talked about 5 months ago and I've been talking about for a couple of years. Most people can see it. They can feel it. They're losing control.
Do you largely agree with the premise that credit needs to expand and then there's two kind of ways to tackle the issue? There's the way that the Trump administration is coming in trying to do it. They're trying to grow their way out of the problem by reducing tax. And then there's a tax your way out of the problem.
Let me reply with a nuclear option. The government should not issue currency at all.
What is the one truth Australians don't want to face right now, in your opinion?
Very simple. The government is not the solution. It is the problem. That's it.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Unemployable Podcast. On today's episode, we're welcoming back a man who seems to have a talent for stirring the pot, Topher Field. How are you, Topher?
I'm doing very well. I'm worried that we just won't have enough to talk about. There's been so little going on in the world. We're going to run out of things in 10 minutes.
Yeah, I was wondering whether I should actually attend this one or not. It might be a bit of a yawn session.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing going on.
Second time around, I mean, you were here 5 months ago, so this one's, there's a lot that has happened since then. But for those of you guys that don't know, Topher is a filmmaker, activist, and a professional rule questioner. Topher made waves during the Melbourne lockdowns by reminding all of us that sometimes good people do break bad laws. So buckle up, because we're about to dive deep into free speech, what's happening in the housing crisis, and everyone else that keeps Topher and everything else that keeps Topher awake at night, and probably makes all of us a little bit nervous. So welcome back and thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you. I usually get, when people invite me back a second time, it's usually to force me to apologize for what I said the first time. So this is quite refreshing. Yeah.
And I want to start by saying congratulations, because since you were here in May, we're now recording this in late September, and in between there, you've hit 100,000 subscribers on YouTube and you got your YouTube plaque.
Yes, I did, and no offense to YouTube, but that is a cheap plastic piece of crap.
We might need to edit that bit out of it. You'll lose it.
No, they call it the new lightweight design. I don't know what the old ones were like, but they were physically bigger. These are smaller, and it's all just plastic, and it looks like brushed aluminium. But honestly, I don't care, because it's what it means that is significant.
Right?
And it's quite remarkable. So I saw this spate of videos coming out recently from Australian content creators that are very notably left-wing, to one degree or another. And I won't name names, but they released videos saying, we're being crushed by the algorithm. One of them even said, is this the end? Yeah, am I going to go out of business? I can't make money like this. Because their views had fallen off a cliff. And I went and did some research, and both Meta and YouTube have recently done what they called a rebalancing or a removal of the tilting of their algorithm. I'm like, I'm sorry, did you just admit that you've been tilting the algorithm the whole time? And is that why my content's doing, have I been working against an unseen headwind for years? And these other guys have had a tailwind that they didn't know they had, and they just thought they were geniuses.
Yeah.
And now that that's actually been leveled and we're on the same playing field, they're all of a sudden kicking up a stink. And I'm sitting here going, wow, this is amazing. Yeah. That's like the sun just came out on my channel.
But it really is, in my opinion, a real thing, because I mean, I look at the analytics in our channel on a daily basis, right? It's like an addiction.
Sure.
How many times do you look at YouTube Studio?
Please don't ask.
Right?
Yeah.
And ever since we've been being a little bit more kind of political, talking about different things, especially since the Tommy Robinson kind of podcast and stuff, I feel like, you know, the headwinds are a little bit stronger at the moment, whether that's true or not, but who knows. But I guess, you know, there's a lot to talk about today. We've got to try and pack this in within an hour to hour and a half. We've got the Charlie Kirk assassination. We've got obviously the housing crisis that's deepening in this country. The Tommy Robinson march in the UK that just happened, and Adam and Perry, our CEO, and Adam, obviously our business partner, who everyone knows, actually went to the march and had media passes, which was pretty cool. I want to talk a little bit too about the economic reform, or what you called the tax fest. The talk fest.
Gosh.
Let's see where we go. But I just thought it was interesting when I was looking back at our original podcast, and we had over 700 comments on that pod, over 50,000 views, all organic. And most of the comments were so positive. The people loved you. They just loved how you can, that we allowed you to sit there and talk rather than us, you know, just cutting in and trying to, you know, put it in a kind of, I guess, our direction. Mm. So I really want to let that flow today the same way, because we got to listen to the people that are listening to us, and give them the attention that, they need. So I think it would be a good one, to start talking about Charlie Kirk, because it was just the memorial that just literally happened in the last few hours.
Yeah, 3 o'clock this morning our time, and, as we record this.
You know, off camera, we were talking about seeing how obviously Donald Trump was there, Elon Musk was there, Grant Cardone was there, and a lot of different famous people. But I guess one of the questions I have for you is, how did that assassination hit you personally?
Yeah.
Like what's been your reaction in your circles?
Personally, it actually hit me harder than I would have expected. And I had to reflect on why. And it felt incredibly personal. I've never met Charlie. I respect his work from afar, as many people do. I'm just one of the millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people. I appreciate his work. I like his videos. I think he's really impressive. That's it. There's no deeper connection there. And yet his assassination really, really hit me at a very, very deep level. And, you know, me being who I am, I ask myself, why? What is this saying about me, about Charlie? Why does this feel so personal? And I realized there's multiple layers to it. I'll start with this one. The injustice of it being him. Now, the injustice of it being anyone, of course, you know, no one should be using bullets to try and to solve arguments. But of all of the people, it was the people who literally handed them a microphone. You know, there are other people who preach from a pulpit or who hold stadium shows or who have sort of one-way broadcasts. He was the two-way guy. Mm. And the injustice of it being him, of everybody, that for some reason, as I thought about it, that really offended me and cut really deeply, because it is a little bit of a gloves-off moment. There are no rules now. If he's the target, if he's the one they picked, then there's no one off limits. Where everyone who dares to speak common sense is a potential target. But it's to see him cut down in the prime of his life, 31 years of age. I wasn't even married by 31 years of age. He's married, he's got two kids. And as I began to think, and then we saw the reaction, the groundswell, and of course we all realized, well, we're not the only ones feeling this way. There's literally worldwide. Why was he so significant?
Sorry, didn't see you there. While you're here, actually, we've got a new coaching cohort that just opened up for the Unemployable Property Coaching Program that you get taught on how to become a property developer. One-on-one coaching, bi-monthly coaching, and also events where we get a full coach bus with all the students and go to 6-7 different development sites. When I say development sites, from one lot to 10 lots to 50 lots, you get to see exactly why we buy it, how we buy it, how we fund it, and also how you can do it yourself. The next day, we had an amazing event at the QT Hotel here on the Gold Coast, where we had all of our consultants come in and teach everybody on what they're looking for with sites, what are the different trends, and how you can become a property developer yourself. Now you see me on the video, but who you're gonna be getting coached by is Shannon and Carson. Who's Shannon and Carson? 4 years ago, Carson was cleaning carpets. Shannon was a machine operator. Today, they're doing over $100 million worth of land deals. I know you're listening, and I know you want to take action. And if that's you, click on the link below or go to www.unemployableproperty.com.au and register your interest, and one of our team will reach out to you, and we'll see you on the next bus. Now get out of here.
And I came to realize that for younger people, he was the embodiment of what Jordan Peterson talked about. Jordan Peterson talked about get up, make your bed, become excellent at something, slay your dragons, get married, have kids, make sacrifices for something bigger than yourself.
Learn to speak well.
Learn to speak well.
Charlie, you know,
know why you believe what you believe. Have arguments and debates with people. You know, Jordan Peterson in his 12 Rules for Life and then 12 More Rules for Life and in all of his work has been advocating this kind of way of life. And for younger people, they found that inspiring, but he was the grandfather figure. He wasn't the role model. He was too far removed. He was too far out of touch. Charlie, I don't think on purpose, but Charlie, just by living as he lived according to his values, for literally tens of millions of especially young men, became the role model. He became the aspiration. In the same way that you've got people like Andrew Tate trying to become a materialistic aspiration. He's out there with his money and his nonsense, in my opinion, his ego, and he's saying, this is what being a man is like. He's connecting. He's got an audience because there are young people desperately looking for what does it mean to be a man? And they find him, some people. But a lot of people, a lot of young men found Charlie Kirk. And they said, here's this guy. He's phenomenally intelligent. He's articulate. He's brave and he's bold, but he's also compassionate. He married the cheerleader, the winner of the beauty pageants. He's got two kids. He's the embodiment of everything that grandfather Jordan Peterson has been telling me about. Charlie Kirk was the proof that it worked.
The thing is as well, and you mentioned Andrew Tate, there's a lot of these left-wing or right-wing people with extreme views that have pulled an audience because they've appealed to people who were already on their side of thinking and on the debate. One of the reasons why I think Charlie Kirk was so powerful and ultimately what got him killed is because he wasn't extremist in his views. He was quite conservative in his views, common sense, as you mentioned. And he was able to swing people who didn't see the world that way or weren't part of an already existing base.
And I think it's really important, if we're going to talk about Charlie, it's important to talk about why. And so I did a tribute video to him, not that it's my place to do that. I had no connection with him, but I wanted people to see what was it about how he did what he did that made him so effective. And it's very simple. The rules of persuasion are very, very simple. The first thing you have to do is find some common ground and meet somebody where they're at. And the fact is, we have common ground with absolutely everybody. I think that Marxism is literally a death cult that is going to kill, you know, it's already killed hundreds of millions of people and will in the future. But if I meet a Marxist, I can still find common ground with them. You know how? They'll say to me, I think that workers should be able to live with dignity and have a living wage and be able to afford to live a dignified life as a worker. I agree. I absolutely agree. We just found our common ground. We can work together from that point. And if you watch Charlie's debates, he is the master of finding and acknowledging that common ground. But what he then does, which is so rare, people who are bold in their position often choose not to find the common ground to start with. Mm-hmm. People who choose to find the common ground then become mealy-mouthed and whataboutists and having an each-way bet and never actually stand firmly on their position. Charlie was the master of the art of meeting someone where they are at, acknowledging the area in which they were right, and saying, yes, you know what, that thing that you've just said to me, you're hurting because of, let's say, in the Australian context, some young person comes up to you and says, I want to smash capitalism because of the failure of the housing crisis and the way things are going, I'll never be able to own a home. You know what, smashing capitalism, terrible idea, because capitalism is not the problem, but the housing crisis, very real. The despair that they feel at not having a future, very real. Let's meet them where they're at. Let's start there. Instead of going, no, capitalism's the answer. Well, that is the answer. But you start by meeting them where they're at.
It wasn't just that with Charlie Kirk, though. It wasn't like that was a tactic for him. I remember he did an interview with Tucker Carlson, and Tucker Carlson said, basically, what is the number one problem here? What is going on? And he started with that. He said the number one problem is economic.
Yeah.
He said the number one problem is that kids these days cannot do as well as their parents did because the economic conditions are not set up for them to succeed.
Yeah.
So he starts with the problem, not the symptom.
Yeah.
And a lot of these other left-wing, right-wing, they always talk about the symptoms because that's what gets them engagement.
But in terms of persuasion, at that individual one-on-one level, the reason they shot him was for exactly what you said before. He was not just being polemic and gathering an audience of people that already agreed with him. Mm-hmm. He was taking people that didn't agree with him and not necessarily making them agree with him, but bringing them one step closer. Mm-hmm. There's an analogy that I may have given 5 months ago when I was on here, and I apologize if I did, but changing people's minds is like gathering pippies off a pier, right? If you've ever gone as a kid, you ever go and get pippies off a pier, right? You can drive in the car, you've got your bucket, you've got your pliers or something to be able to get those rotten things off. The hardest part is actually cracking them off their existing position. Once you've done that, you chuck them in the bucket, stick them in the boot, that's easy. Getting them to leave the position that they currently hold, that's the bit that's hard. And too often we focus on, you haven't come all the way to the destination of where I want you to be. No. The triumph is to get someone to go, I realize I'm not 100% right. That's the challenge. And that's what Charlie achieves by meeting people where they're at.
You mentioned just in that why they shot him. And just to dispel a few myths out there, obviously the internet's ablaze with the conspiracy theories and Benjamin Netanyahu or whoever it is. Can you like give us your take on the reasoning why, and is it all horseshit? And just like...
Look, I think the latest hot take I heard was that the return of Christ had happened and the first thing Jesus did was shoot Charlie or something. I'm not quite sure, but there's some pretty crazy stuff out there, right? No, he was shot by a guy who had drunk the Kool-Aid. So it's amazing to watch the media playing both sides of this. And I will answer the question, but I want to answer it through the lens of how it's being talked about. You know, I'm watching Australian commentators talking about how the Democratic leadership all condemned the violence. They all said the right things. And the Republican leadership all wanted to politicize the violence. And they just wanted to whip up fear and everything else. No, hang on. What you say after an assassination is not nearly as relevant as what was said before. And you cannot pretend that the Democratic leadership, the mainstream media around the world, as well as Australian politicians as well, demonizing Donald Trump, making comparisons to Hitler, saying that the MAGA movement is the new Hitler Youth, talking about these kinds of terms, and then knowing full well that, for example, in high schools, we have these ethical questions as part of ethics classes or psychology classes in university. You know, if you had the chance to kill Hitler as a baby, would that be the right thing to do?
Really? Wow.
Right? Now, these are the sort of thought experiments they're playing with in high schools and in universities. So when the Democrats come out and say, this guy is literally Hitler, what are you saying at that point? It's no surprise that someone took, a couple of people tried to take out Donald Trump. And so them turning around and condemning the violence after it's happened, when they were the ones who laid the groundwork for it, they built the entire foundation for it. Now, when you get a shooter, in this case, raised in a conservative family, it's no coincidence. So the shooter against Donald Trump who hit him in the ear, he was raised in a progressive family, couldn't shoot straight. The guy who shot Charlie Kirk in the neck, raised in a conservative family, taught by his dad how to hunt up in Alaska. Tragically, the result was his shot landed. And you've got this kid who was raised in a conservative family, whose mind was poisoned in university, gets into a relationship with a transgender person who he's now living in with, who, by the way, also came from a conservative family and has rebelled against that. And they drank the Kool-Aid. They went all the way in. And I'm not sure if I talked in the last podcast about how that younger generation is splitting. There are the people going deep into the Kool-Aid end, and there is a huge cohort that are actually rejecting it altogether because they're seeing the consequences of it. The problem that we've got now, as the world is healing, we're watching this incredible social movement happen in the 2020s, which is literally the counterpoint to the 1960s sexual revolution. We are watching the other end of that pendulum swing right now. What's happening is a new generation of bitter clingers is being born. These are people who will forever look back on 2021 and 2022 and 23 and say, back when we had pronouns, back when no one was allowed to misgender us, back when we, all we had to say is, I'm offended, and instantly we won every argument. That will forever for them be the heyday, the halcyon days, the high point of civilization. In the same way as there were people who moved to Argentina and grew old and died wishing that Hitler had won the Second World War. They were the bitter clingers out of that era. In the same way as, in American politics, I want to say the bitter clingers clinging to God and guns, right? The new generation of bitter clingers are clinging to pronouns and clinging to gender identities, and the world is now moving against them. Those people who have nailed their flag to that mast, who have burnt all of their friendships and relationships, in the case of these two kids, rejected their families and burnt all of those bridges, as they watch the world moving away from them, they will become incredibly dangerous people. And we saw that out working with Charlie Kirk.
What do you think is going to happen moving forward in the future with free speech? Because obviously with free speech, it includes the right to offend, right? But in this situation, obviously the right to offend took someone's life. So do you think that's going to be something that is going to hold people back, right? Because again, Topher, you talk about a lot of controversial things, right?
Sure.
We do from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, I mean, we're nowhere near the level of Charlie Kirk.
Yeah.
Did it cross your mind at any point in time where it was like, ooh, man, maybe that can happen to yourself as an example? Because you're starting to grow a lot of, gain a lot of momentum in this kind of space. And you're doing a lot of talks and you're on a lot of podcasts and different things.
Yeah.
And this is the thing, like, is it going to inspire us more to speak out, or are people going to retract?
So, I mean, you and I, and you've acknowledged this already in the way you asked the question, we're not on the same level. There's no comparison, and none of us are trying to pretend that there is. But let's fast forward 10 years and say that things go really well my way. Yes, I could end up in a situation where that becomes a real consideration. What's really interesting, if you look at political assassinations and violence around the world, and I looked into this for a potential video that I've decided not to do, but if you look at political assassinations in the last 20 years of journalists, politicians, activists, so not just actual politicians, but also the people that are contributing to and around politics, the numbers were actually not that different between mainland USA and, say, the European Union. European Union has about 100 million more people, and pro rata, the numbers weren't that different until 2025. 30% of all acts of political assassination that have happened in advanced countries, so I'm ruling out, you know, third world, Middle East, whatever, in advanced economies, 30% of all of the politically motivated assassinations have happened this calendar year, 2025, in the United States. We have not heard about the vast majority of them. They never made the news. These are activists. These are politicians. Now, obviously, they made the news in the US more than they did here, but these are politicians that we might never have heard of over here. So they're just not relevant. They don't make the headlines over here. And almost exclusively, not quite exclusively, but almost exclusively, they have been committed by people who are ardent leftists, usually either transgender themselves or adjacent to transgender, such as the shooter in Charlie Kirk's case. This is the generation of bitter clingers. This is the outworking of that. I'm of the view that this is a spasm. This is a spasm of violence as they lose their grip. They thought that the future was theirs. They are recognizing now that social shift that we talked about 5 months ago, and I've been talking about for a couple of years. I saw it coming. I called it. Now most people can see it. They can see it. They can feel it. They're losing control. We are watching a spasm of violence. Now, I would caution, though, against people saying this is unprecedented and being apocalyptic in their language. Yep. Go back to the 1960s and 1970s. Have a look at the Weather Underground. Have a look at the bombings. Have a look at the assassinations. Martin Luther King Jr. being one that we know about. But there were an enormous, JFK obviously being another one that we know about. There were a huge number of assassinations. Political violence, unfortunately, is actually much more the default position of the world.
With you mentioned JFK, since that assassination, it is now confirmed that the CIA had an involvement in that assassination?
In the minds of people that want to see it that way, it's confirmed. In the minds of people that don't, it's a Rorschach test. I tend to think that the CIA were very clearly involved. I think it's very obvious that the CIA were involved, but for some people, there is no amount of evidence that would convince them that it's been confirmed.
And I agree with you. I've had a look through history, and being someone who does macro, I follow a lot of macro guys that have said, get ready, because there's going to be a lot more political assassinations during this era, given the phase and the cycle that we're currently in, etc. And you've made a pretty compelling case for why, you know, the radical leftists could be involved in these assassinations. But what about things like the CIA and higher powers being involved?
Well, I would have to say the only narrative around the shooter, I can't think of his name, the shooter who took a pot shot at Trump and hit him in the ear, the only narrative that makes sense around him is that he was being equipped and supported by the deep state, by the US deep state intelligence agencies in particular. He had multiple burner phones. He clearly had handlers. There was so much going on around him. The fact that we know so little about him, you get a school shooter and if it turns out that they're a conservative or if they're a white dude, then we know what they had for breakfast 16 years ago. If they're someone who sort of doesn't quite suit the media narrative, we know next to nothing
it's
about
come out of nowhere.
Have a look at how little we know about that guy that shot Donald Trump in the ear still. we know next to nothing about him.
And his house was completely scraped.
Well, yeah, it's all been, you know, the rooftop was tidied up and cleaned before forensics teams had even gotten in there. This is where the supposed attempted assassin of a past and prospective future president of the United States was then shot in reply by the protective services detail. And yet they were mopping up the crime scene before forensics had actually gotten in there and had a look. There's a lot about all of that. So I don't rule that out at all. Mm-hmm. You got to understand that the deep state, the swamp, it is the bureaucrats, it is the advisors. And there has in the past been a symbiotic relationship. So in Australia, let's talk of the Australian context. Anthony Albanese, Chris Bowen, etc., they love the bureaucracy. They are best friends. The bureaucrats create mountains of paperwork. They throw millions of dollars at advisors and consultants to do studies and to come out with pieces of paper. That, because they're being paid to get a particular outcome, support whatever it is that the politician wanted to do. Nowhere is that clearer than in climate change policy right now. We've just had another doom and gloom report come out about that. Off the back of that, they announced these big, you know, ambitious CO2 reductions targets that will make no measurable difference to the global temperature because no one else is following our lead. By the way, the definition of a leader is someone that others follow. It's really hilarious to me when they want to say, oh, Australia is leading the way, nobody's following.
Yeah, everyone's doing the opposite.
Yeah, no one's following. They say pretty things, but look at the numbers. You know, it's all public. Go to Our World in Data and have a look at what's happening with global CO2 emissions. So the bureaucrats, the consultants, they literally are the swamp in which these politicians swim. And what they do is they provide cover. The politicians can maneuver and they're never accountable. They're never able to be pinned down and held responsible. So that's a symbiotic relationship. When you get a politician that actually starts to work against its own swamp, it is a little bit like a fish trying to work against the ocean. This is the habitat in which they're meant to survive, in which they're meant to swim. And that swamp will try and eject them. That swamp will try and reject them because they are the only thing that is a danger to the swamp is not a change in government. It's someone who doesn't want to swim in the swamp.
Mm-hmm. Now that I think we should move on from Charlie. Again, you know, God rest his soul.
Mm.
In respect to him and his family. You mentioned Australia.
Mm.
And let's lead it back to Australia. What scares you the most about where Australia is heading?
What scares me the most is the fact that I've seen where Venezuela got to. And I talked about that last time. And on my own podcast, my viewers have started a drinking game. Every time I mention Venezuela, they have to take a shot. I think about 16 people have been admitted to hospital with the alcohol poisoning at this point. Because I talk about it a lot because it really did completely, even for me, I knew this stuff. And then when I saw it, it scared me because it felt so normal. Because you realize that we all think that totalitarianism looks like jackboots in the streets and secret police kicking doors down every night. And then you see what totalitarianism and complete socialist collapse actually looks like in reality. And you realize that you could very easily convince yourself that everything's fine if you just don't look at the breadlines, if you just don't look at the malnutrition, right? You could walk down the streets of Caracas City and if you just lifted your eyes above street level and you go, oh, that's lovely old architecture. And yeah, okay, the paint's peeling and things are crumbling a little bit, but it's not that much worse than Melbourne. And let's ignore the fact that inside our hotel room, it had a beautiful two-sink bathroom layout and only one of the sinks actually had plumbing. And let's ignore the fact that the only thing that got stolen from us the whole time we were in Caracas was one of the rolls of toilet paper that we brought in with our luggage. We'd flown in with toilet paper and about 480 condoms, by the way. That's a story I can tell if you'd like me to. And the only thing that got stolen from us the whole time in Caracas was that someone who serviced our room stole one of our rolls of toilet paper because they can't get it for love nor money in that country. You know, but you can convince yourself, the birds are still chirping. There are still cars going past you in the street. The sun is still shining. You could convince yourself. What shocked me about Caracas was how familiar it felt to Melbourne. And what that allowed me to do was to tune in to the actual signs. And we talked about the five signs, and that's, I think, was a big part of why our last podcast went as well as it did, because we can talk about specific signs of this is what to look for, and this is, we're doing these same things. And in terms of those signs, one of the ones that I talked about was the nationalization of industry and how it doesn't necessarily come through ownership, it can come through regulation. And this is exactly what we're seeing right now. We are seeing the complete nationalization of the Australian energy grid. and through energy prices, the de facto nationalisation of Australian industries. Because by driving up Australian energy prices, an enormous number of industries become non-viable and then become government dependent on welfare, on corporate welfare, which I'm wholeheartedly opposed to. But they're saying it's necessary because otherwise we're going to lose all these jobs. Well, why? Because power prices have made these industries non-viable. So we're watching a de facto nationalization of what amounts to the heights of the economy, to steal an old Soviet phrase, where originally the Soviets wanted to control the price of absolutely everything, micromanage the economy down to the nth degree. That became unworkable, so they shifted their strategy. They said, we just have to control the heights of the economy. We need to control the energy industry, the transport industry. We need to control your heavy industry, your big exporters, and these sorts of things. It's like, well, that's exactly what we're doing through power prices right now. We're controlling all of our heavy industry, all of our mining, all of our smelting, our transport industry. All of these are heavily energy dependent industries. And the government is taking de facto control of all of them through power prices and through their ensuing dependency on government welfare and handouts. So we're watching the nationalization of industry Australia-wide under the guise of saving the planet right now. We're watching that happen. So back to your question, the thing that scares me is that I can see it, and no offense, other people think they can see it, but until you've actually identified how normal it really feels, and then you realize my neighbor's not going to wake up. You know, we have this idea at some point it's going to get so bad. And then I went to a city where it was so bad, and I spoke to people at protests. There was a protest that happened in the central gardens of Caracas City, and I'm watching people lined up to get a free t-shirt from the government, and there's propaganda playing on TVs, and there's security and police all over the place. And I've got a translator there, and I'm chatting with them, and they're saying to me, oh, I'm so grateful. Isn't it amazing that we have a socialist government that is giving me a t-shirt? Because you know what? Without them, I couldn't afford to buy my own t-shirt. They're saying that without irony. They mean every word. And I look into their eyes, and there are people that I meet in Australia, and I go, I've met you before. Mm-hmm. I met you on the streets of Caracas City. You were the person who still couldn't see it when your own kid was malnourished, when your own wife or husband couldn't get medical treatment, when you were hungry and starving and you were lined up for a free t-shirt from the government that had destroyed your life, and you're there going, thank you, thank you, thank you. I've met you before. That's the thing that scares me the most.
Am I thinking of the right thing, the prisoner's dilemma, where they're really, really nice to the prisoner, the communist
military. And breaking your chains. So there is a saying that came out of Nazi Germany and Europe, that the Nazis were lovely people. You know, the public, the everyday ones, the party members, right? The one, the go along to get along ones. They were the lovely people. The nasty people were the resistors. They were nasty. They would kill sympathizers. They would, you know, they were setting traps and killing soldiers. These were the mean people. There is a level of agreeableness that makes you actually a menace. The banality of evil, I think, was the Hannah Arendt book or concept, the banality of evil. Evil is, in Australia, is in the form of regulations being signed by people in suits in very respectable office buildings and people in uniforms with badges, whether that's police or other types of enforcement or bureaucratic badges, going about their business and just doing their jobs in a very banal way. And that, having been to Venezuela and seen with my own eyes what this looks like, I am watching evil spread around this country, and I'm watching many Australians who ought to know better celebrating it, participating in it, and actually aiding and abetting it, and having no idea that me, the evil rabble-rouser who's causing all these problems and writing about civil disobedience and advocating for all these mean, awful, horrible things, history's going to judge them far more harshly than it will judge me.
There's actually some studies on this that were done, and I read them in Alex Karp's book, The Technological Republic, founder of Palantir. And there were some studies that were done, I think back in the 40s or 50s after the war, that were done in Germany, and it was about complicity, right? And then they repeated these studies in America.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what happened is they got 10 people, and 9 people were in on the joke, right? Where there was 2 boxes and there was 3 lines in a box and there was 1 line in another box. And they had to say which line in the box of 3 was the same as the line in the box of 1. And it was clear, But they got the 9 people before them to pick, on purpose, pick the wrong line.
Mm.
and some ridiculous amount of people would go along with the wrong answer based on that.
Yeah.
And it kind of debunked a bit of a myth that what happened in Germany was just a case of Germans being more evil than the rest of the world.
That's exactly
that
right.
That could happen anywhere when there's a compliant...
The book that I would encourage everyone to get a hold of and read, it's not easy to get a hold of anymore, but it is available. I think it's actually gone into reprint because people have realized its relevance, is a book called They Thought They Were Free. It was written by someone whose name will come to me in a moment. And it was a study of, so he was sent by the University of Chicago, he was a Jewish German American who was sent after the war by the University of Chicago to spend a year in a university town in Germany and befriend Nazis. So he had a cover story of what he was doing at the university, some cross-cultural whatever. But his actual job was to befriend Nazis, not the Hermans and the Gorings and the Himmlers, but the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the guys that were party members and party supporters, and actually understand them and their grievances. And the reality is, yes, it was an enormous amount of just going along to get along, which is what it's been identified with a lot of those studies. But also, it's a lot of correctly identifying the problems and then prescribing the wrong solutions. And this is something I talk about a lot. And this is why it's so important to meet people where they're at, which is usually identifying the problem. A lot of people correctly identify the problem. That's not what makes them evil. It's when they apply the wrong solution and they pursue the wrong solution and they demonize anyone that's pursuing a different solution to solve the same problem. Mm. That's where the divide becomes so really, 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 really dangerous. If COVID taught me anything, it's that the only reason that my own, in many cases, family and friends and workmates and neighbors have never been Nazis and complicit in war crimes and genocide is because they haven't had the opportunity yet. Right? That's the tragic reality that you realize.
Yeah.
The same people, and this includes Christians. I'm a Christian. There are a shocking number of Christians who went along unthinkingly with the government shutting down churches and dictating to people when they could worship and how. To this day, we have laws around what you're allowed to pray. We have blasphemy laws in Australia. If someone comes to their pastor saying, listen, I'm having confused feelings about my gender identity, and I think maybe I was born in the wrong body. If that pastor does anything other than encourage transition, if that pastor says, hey, listen, let's maybe just wait a little while. He's a criminal or she's a criminal. If that pastor says, you know what, let's pray about this and maybe let's pray that you come to accept the way you've been designed and the way that you've been born and you come to celebrate that for yourself rather than trying to change that, that pastor is now a criminal. Prison sentences include up to 5 years. Fines of six figures, over $110,000. Now, this is law in Victoria and in New South Wales right now. We have these laws on the books already. This is the banality of evil. This is some bureaucrat, some politician somewhere decided that there were votes to be found or there was power and prestige to be gained in writing these laws. And now someone's going to say something and a judge will issue a warrant and a police officer who signed up because they thought they were going to be chasing bad guys and helping little old ladies cross the street is going to say, oh, we've got an arrest warrant for this person. They're going to go and arrest them and shove them in a cell. And then they're going to go through the meat grinder of the court process and everyone's just going to do their jobs. In exactly the same way that the train driver did his job on the way to Auschwitz.
Are people getting arrested for that here in Australia? Because I know in UK they definitely are.
To my knowledge, there's been no arrests yet. Yeah. No one's really popped their head up to be the test case for that one that I know of. But what's really, really dangerous about it is that it has an enormously chilling effect. In order for it to change people's behavior, people don't have to have been prosecuted.
Already complied.
People just have to know that they could be or they will be.
You mentioned before about protests and New South Wales and Victoria and whatnot. What's your take on the recent marches and the injustice to the Aussie protesters holding their own flag and getting... Unpack this for us because
There's a lot of layers to this. Mm. And if I go through every single layer, I promise you sooner or later I will have pissed off every single person listening to this podcast.
I agree.
Because multiple things can be true at once,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is a really, really important concept. So number one, the demonization of the Australian flag is the utter absurdity. Now, I'm a libertarian. I am literally the most pro-immigration open borders guy you could possibly imagine. But if there is any organization that should be jingoistic, that should be loyal to its own people, it is a government. because it is in fact obliged to be loyal to the people that fund it, the people that voted for it, the people that actually constitute the country that it apparently represents. In the same way that a board of directors can be found guilty of being in breach of fiduciary duty to maximize value to shareholders if they do anything other than maximize value to shareholders, a government, politicians, bureaucrats doing anything other than maximizing value and maximizing the value of the country that literally created it, it pays its bills and selected it, for them to do anything else should be criminal. And for them to be sitting there saying, no, Senator Jacinta Price, you can't wear an Australian flag on the Senate floor. To be sitting there and demonizing so much about the very country that they represent. This is the one organization that, in my opinion, has absolutely no right to do any of that. I think it's nonsense. And people need to lose their jobs. Bureaucrats and politicians. Politicians shouldn't be able to be fired by anyone other than the voting public. But I think the voting public should throw every politician that has agreed with this ban on flags in the parliament out on their ear at the next election. Bureaucrats that have supported it need to be fired. And if necessary, entire departments shut down, in my opinion. But that's the libertarian in me speaking, because I think we'd be better off with a fraction of the government that we have. So the idea that the Australian people would look at their own government and the fact that their own government refuses to be proud of our own flag and would respond by getting out there with flags and saying, hey, no, we're Australian and we're proud of our heritage. We're proud of who we are. People flock from all over the world to join what we are. I think that's a good and a healthy and a valid thing. However, along with them, there are people that want to take advantage of the fact that, hey, there's going to be a big crowd. And this is exactly what happened with the was it the September 19th? Was that, have I got that date right? I can't remember. October 31st.
August
31st. Was it? Goodness, time flies, doesn't it? Was it that long ago already?
August 31st.
Gosh. Okay. With these rallies the date was popularized by a TikTok video that went viral. A young guy started up a new account, made AI videos. They took off and all of a sudden everyone's talking about this date. He had no intention of actually creating or organizing a protest. That's a huge amount of work. And the person who got a hold of it, unfortunately, is someone who was fantastic during the COVID lockdowns and has since really bought into this white supremacy stuff. And I've got her on record with recordings and so forth. Really vicious, awful stuff. They've gone all the way down the anti-Semitism, making really awful jokes and basically literally saying, and I've got her on recording, literally saying that when we support Australian culture, what we're really talking about is white culture. Now, there is a world of difference between saying the Australian culture that we inherited came out of a European culture that was majority white at the time. That's a fact. That's a historical fact. Right, that's a matter of record. To then say, therefore, we have to keep Australia white in order for us to keep our culture, well, that's a non sequitur, right? One is historically true; it came out of white Europe. To say, therefore, only white people can have this culture, yeah. And the challenge that I bring back to people that want to play the culture war side of things is: so, which white culture do you want? Is that Daniel Andrews' white culture? Mm-hmm. Maybe Jacinta Allen, maybe Anthony Albanese. These are all good. Good white European names. Is it their culture that you want Australia to be run under? Or can we actually accept that the color of someone's skin is not a good predictor of culture? It's not actually a good predictor of whether someone is going to help to build a freer and more prosperous country, which is fundamentally, that's actually what we're arguing about. It's what we want.
This is the one big one we see in the comments all the time that I have a little bit of trouble with, people saying, you know, let's get rid of all these people, let's get rid of those people, let's go back to this. I mean, also, MAGA, it's a great marketing campaign, but you can't go back to what was. Evolution, we can't go back to an evolutionary state that we previously were. We can only move forward.
Yeah.
And we have to build upon the culture that we have. And so that's why I kind of have trouble with these going back to a previous state.
But then the next step is to realize that these people could have this big fight about immigration and wave the flags and do all of that stuff. And let's say they win. All right. I'm putting it in air quotes because honestly, they're not winning anything. They just don't understand that yet. So immigration drops to zero. Crime will remain an enormous problem because that's not just an immigrant thing. We just had down in Melbourne, a couple had were both murdered in their homes and he had his head cut off and stuck on a spike. That wasn't done by an immigrant. Right? Inflation will remain out of control. That's being done by people in government who are, guess what? Majority white. That's not a race problem. That's a communism problem. We've got a housing crisis. That's the one thing that might be temporarily improved. But actually, I've run the numbers on this. We have been building enough houses to keep up with immigration. People don't realize this. If you look at the number of dwellings in Australia right now, as a ratio of population, it is better, not worse, than it was 20 years ago. We are building enough dwellings. There are two fundamental reasons why we still have a housing crisis despite building enough dwellings. Number one is a lot of those are, like the pictures behind you, high-rise apartments. Now, they're only suitable to a certain demographic. I lived in an apartment when I was single. Got married and had a kid in an apartment. And then once our kid was about 2 years old, we were like, screw this apartment living. This does not work for us anymore. And we've lived, you know, somewhere where we've got some land ever since. Apartments only work for a certain demographic, so they're never going to be a solution for the broader population. But actually, that's the smaller of the two problems. The biggest problem is that we are not building houses that are the bottom rung of the ladder. And people think I'm cruel. I would much rather people live in tired old houses with no air conditioning than under a bridge. But if I say, you know what? Landlords shouldn't have to install air conditioning because it's going to increase the rent and it's going to push somebody out of living in a tired, old, unair-conditioned house into living under a bridge. Then I'm the bad guy. You want people to live in poverty. No, I don't want people to live in poverty, but I want people who are in poverty to be able to live in some sort of a house. We need the bottom rungs of the ladder. Now, can I finish that thought? What we're building right now in Australia, the minimum standards are not the bottom rungs of the ladder. No one's allowed to build an entry-level home anymore. And that's not that's a combination of regulation that physically stops them, but also the regulations that create an economic reality that means that they never will. No developer opening up new land is going to build anything less than a three-bedroom house. They're going to try and cram four bedrooms onto 400 square meters of land because that's how they maximize their returns. And building a house is so freaking expensive that they're never going to do anything other than try and maximize their returns. Why is it so freaking expensive? Well, studies have been done. More than half of the cost of a new build is now the cost of government. So a new build, an entry-level new build in the outer middle of nowhere suburbs of southeastern Melbourne is $800,000 right now. $400,000 of that is the direct and indirect cost of government and regulation on that building. So even if we were to build entry-level houses, they would still be ridiculously overpriced. The housing crisis is government-made. And this is why I say, even if they win the immigration debate, it's not going to fix the housing crisis. Because it's not actually the number of people, it's the fact that we are not building the kinds of houses that allow people to get onto the entry-level rung of the ladder.
Exactly. And the biggest factor with relation to the increase in housing prices is availability of credit. And the reality is that we are not, no Western country around the world is in a position to decrease the amount of credit available. And so therefore they won't. So that vacuum will get, whether it's immigrants or not, it'll be wealthy Australians, it'll be whoever can afford houses, unless they decrease the availability of credit. Housing prices are going up. As you increase the availability of credit, so goes the increase in housing prices.
You're ignoring the impact of changes in supply. In a static market, increasing the availability of credit will absolutely drive demand and will therefore drive prices up. If we actually start supplying the market with entry-level housing, I mean, you know, you could have a near infinite amount of credit. I mean, obviously, infinite doesn't exist in the real world, and it certainly doesn't exist in economics. You can have all of the availability of credit that
it'll
you want.
It'll still push the housing prices up.
But you're still going to choose what you're going to pay for based on your repayments, based on your earning capacity. There is still a limit. The availability of credit hasn't meant that everyone's jumping on a $20 million mansion.
No, but that's the point. The availability of credit means that house prices across the board will continue to rise as credit increases. Well, that's what's happening. What you're saying is it is something completely different. It's there's not enough affordable housing because of regulation and because the supply is not available. But it doesn't mean when that, and I've seen it, right? Yeah. I've seen land, I've sold 3,000 boxes of land, and I've seen land sizes go from average size to 600 to average size 400 to then giving 200 square meter blocks land.
Yeah.
And effectively what happens is that the small affordable ones continue to rise. They rise by a higher percentage than the bigger blocks because of the availability of credit.
So I see what's happening here. So there is an expectation around what an entry-level home is. An entry-level home, the ones being built on 200 square meters, I'm going to take a stab in the dark that they were not like the 1940s and 50s single-story brick units that were being built three to a block when it, you know, that I grew up around. These are double story attempt wannabe luxury townhouses with a fully finished kitchen with a stone bench top, an ensuite bathroom for the master bedroom, and a whole bunch of other things. Now, can I just tell a quick story about my childhood? This is not a sob story. I want to be really clear about this. I had a great childhood, and the home I grew up in was fantastic. We did not have enough bedrooms for one per person. The entire family shared one bathroom for most of my childhood. My parents did eventually put on an add-on ensuite. The toilet that I used for my entire childhood until I was 14 years of age was outside of the house. Mm-hmm. I had to walk out the back door, walk through a breezeway that was freezing cold in the middle of winter, and sit in a Bessa block, you know, stuccoed dunny with a population of about, you know, 4,000 mosquitoes and 200 daddy long legs. At whatever time of day or night, in the heat of summer or the cold of winter, there was no air conditioning anywhere in the house. We had one heater that was located in one part of the house and would only keep that part of the house warm. This was what was called normal. This was entirely normal. This was not an entry-level house. This was actually my parents, you know, I was their fifth kid. That's the home that they bought in their 30s. Mm. And they owned into their 40s before they then moved into a larger house. We've actually lost touch with what an entry level house even is.
No, I'm not disagreeing with your point. I think your point is an extremely valid one. I think that the government, through deregulation, has the power to solve the housing crisis by making it possible for developers to build that kind of housing.
Oh, sure, sure. And that's the regulatory aspect that I talked about.
100%.
Yeah.
I just think that for people to go and then blame developers or to argue against the increase in housing prices, the reality is we live in a global macro environment where the availability of credit cannot be allowed to decrease, because if it does, we will go into a depression. There's been two major opportunities for them to allow credit to decrease. Mm. There was the 30s, the depression, and it was the great financial crisis in 2008.
Yeah.
And the amount of credit available decreased by like a percent.
Yeah.
This is a system that does not allow credit to decrease. So it has to continue to increase. So therefore, we can't stop housing prices going up. They're going to continue to go up because we're in a global debt bubble. The only way is your way is through deregulation.
Yes. Now, can we talk about the debt side of things? Because we can actually flip this conversation on its head and realize that we're not talking about the increase in credit. We're talking about the devaluation of the dollar.
Yeah.
They are one and the same.
Yes,
right?
yes.
And so what's actually happening is our prices are not going up because goods are getting more expensive. Our prices are going up because our dollar is becoming less valuable. The cost of living crisis is not because goods have gotten more expensive. It is because our dollar is being debased and has been ever since, you know.
Yeah, but it's being debased because
credit. Through credit creation. That is the primary tool. And you know, if you understand fractional reserve banking, which I know you guys all do, this is money coming out of nowhere. This is the primary mechanism by which money is brought into existence. And to put it in really crude terms, for those that may not be familiar, this might be the first time you've been exposed to these ideas. In very crude terms, all economists are going to be crying at this analogy. But essentially, if you take the number of dollars in a given currency and take the value of that country in terms of its asset base, its productivity, and all of that, you divide one by the other, and that's kind of your number. That's kind of your value per dollar. That's an exceptionally crude way of looking at it. There's so much more to it. But broadly speaking, if you keep increasing the number of dollars in circulation, but the underlying country is not then building more assets, becoming more productive, developing itself, then the value of those dollars will go down. There is a case to be made for credit creation where it is going into actual assets and things that are actually increasing the underlying base, which in this case is people's faith in the country. I mean, there's no intrinsic value to any of these currencies. It's
Jared Rennick talks about
it. Yeah, Jared Rennick talks about this. And there is a case to be made there. There's certainly a lot of caution needs to be exercised there, because if politicians, you know, discover that they have the power to invent more money, then they do. And that's what we're seeing. You know, they're doing it via the Reserve Bank and they're doing it via credit policy, but they're creating more money in order to keep this GDP growth bubble going. But what we have is a situation where, because of that fear of, oh no, we can't cause a recession by reducing credit supply and the availability of credit, because of that fear, we condemn ourselves to poverty through inflation. And so what we've actually got is a devil's gamble, where they can take their medicine now, which is politically unpopular, or they can kick the can down the road.
It doesn't work, because you've just seen Javier Milei, who tried the austerity, who's tried this. He just lost his recent elections. He just lost power in his recent elections.
So
the problem is people say that this is what they want, But when they are faced with the reality of austerity, it does not work. And the reason I bring that up is because I think everything that we've been spending the last 50 minutes talking about is born of this issue. It's all born of this issue. It's the divide between rich and poor. It's the expanding of a debt bubble. It's the end of an 80 to 100 year debt cycle. That is the source of everything that we've spent the last 50 minutes talking about.
I would say it's the immobility of the poor. People being poor feel it a lot less if they're richer than they were last year. The divide between the rich and poor is a furphy. This idea that this is where your Marxists gain their power, and they say we need to mobilize it against the rich. Studies have been done on this. I think I did mention this a couple of months ago when I was here, that they asked uni students, would you like to swap with John D. Rockefeller, richest man on earth, 120 years earlier? Oh yeah, fantastic. I'd love to be the richest man on earth. That'd be great. Okay, let's have a chat about what his life was actually like. There were no painkillers if you had a hangover. If you wanted to travel, it was a horse-drawn buggy or one of the very early, horseless carriages, but you were on a dirt road or a cobblestone road if you were lucky. There was no air conditioning, et cetera, et cetera. No communication electronically, da-da-da-da. Do you still want to swap with him? No thanks. Apart from a small number of sociopaths who just wanted to be wealthy in comparison to everybody else realized to be John D. Rockefeller would require a reduction in my standard of living. The reason why we see such a heated social debate now is one, because politicians benefit from it, and so they stoke those fires, but two, because we've had a decline in real living standards in Australia. The poor are feeling poorer than they were last year. And that's where the anger kicks in. And in fact, they're poorer than they've been for the last 10 years.
And I think another big reason for this is back in the 60s, back in the 70s, back in the 80s, you really didn't know what people were doing, what kind of car they drove, what kind of house they went to, what holidays they went on, taking food, what food they're eating, what clothes they're wearing, unless you actually physically seen
them. Yeah, unless you knew them.
Whereas today, right, what's the first thing that everyone's wife does, right? When they go to dinner. Well, I shouldn't say everyone. A lot of wives, right? My wife does. First thing she does.
But that's the point. It feels like everyone.
That's right. It takes a photo of the food. Takes a photo of the beach. And what's happening is you've got 100,000 subscribers. You've got X amount of followers on Instagram. So if you show those things, well, guess what? Everyone else is going to see it.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening. We're in a society of just absolute consumption, right? Absolute gluttony in my opinion, and everyone is seeing this. So like even rich people still feel poor. Like it's crazy.
If you're watching,
there's always someone else that's got so much more that you wouldn't have known before.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, we're creating monsters of ourselves because we just want more and more and more.
Yeah.
And that gap, gap looks like and it feels like it is increasing. But you said it before. Everybody wants a 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom house with a white picket fence.
2-bathroom? No, hang on. Right? Sorry. No, 3-bathroom. You know what I mean? Thank you very much.
The pool and the rest of it.
You mean it's only got a double garage?
One ensuite per bathroom.
I need at least 4.
Right. Because why? Because that's what they see. Yeah. Everyone else, right? That's what they see on realestate.com. That's what they see on the block.
Yeah.
And the reality, it is not a reality. We have options right now, right? We bring all kinds of different people on this podcast. We bring in, we just had a rooming housing expert come on the podcast, right? Which he's solving the problem, right? He's solving the problem of people that can't afford to live.
Yeah.
Well, I can give you a room. I can give you a kitchenette
with
your own ensuite if you're a single person and you're going to split the electricity with the 5 others. You're going to split the internet with the 5 others. You're going to split the gas bill with the 5 others.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give you an affordable option.
Yeah.
The issue is the government doesn't back it, number one. And two, you can't get the finance to fund it.
So the exception to that is Victoria. Much to my shock, Victoria are actually allowing you to build, scratch build, dedicated rooming houses.
Yep.
Essentially, they're like single-story apartment buildings, basically.
It's happening here as well.
Is it?
Right?
Okay.
It's happening here as well. So he's done hundreds of them already, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, go to Westpac, go to ANZ, go to CBA to fund it. They will not fund it, right?
In Victoria, they do. That's what I'm saying.
That's good. Yeah. So it's probably changing. Modular housing. These things have been around.
Yeah.
The issue is, I can't live in a modular caravan. Right.
Yeah.
What are people going to... I can't live in a rooming house, right? That's for... that's for the druggies, or that's for the poor people, whatever you want to call it, right?
Yeah.
But it's nurses, teachers,
yeah,
firemen. These are the types of people that are actually renting, because what we're asking, who's renting these homes? Mm. They're $450 to $500 a week, is an example, right? Mm-hmm. So there's options there. The issue is, are you gonna post that on Instagram?
So I've been thinking a lot recently about the levels of wealth, and I don't think we appreciate, if you're watching this podcast, I have some wonderful news for you. You're in the top 1% of wealthiest people that have ever lived in all of human history. Your quality of life is the envy of 99% of all of humanity, even if you're the poorest person who watches this podcast. Sorry, caveat, in Australia. If you're in Australia and watching this. So we have completely lost track of how wealthy we are.
Mm-hmm.
We live like kings, not metaphorically. Literally, we live like kings. We say, well, I don't have a private chef. Yes, you do. You've got hundreds of them lined up on every single street around you that you get to pick from and fire instantly if you don't like what they cook for mm-hmm. you. Oh, that's different. Yeah, you know, I have to pay for my meal. The king has to pay for his chef. The reason why the king had a chef is because he could afford to pay for a chef. So can you. And you do it all the time. And in fact, you pay a delivery person and then you whinge because they took too long. Right? We have staff and servants at our every beck and call. We have technology. We have surveillance technology that would be the envy of World War II military strategists on our phone, and we whinge when it takes 6 seconds to load that satellite photo of that hill that we wanted to look at because we were trying to have an argument with someone about whether the car park was to the left or to the right. And we have a whinge because the internet slowed down. We live like kings. That's not metaphorical. That is literal. And someone renting a one-bedroom bedsitter is living like a king by historical standards. So we've lost track of the actual hierarchy of wealth. The poorest level of wealth is the person who does not know if they're going to live out the day due to poverty, because they, for love nor money, they cannot get clean water, or they haven't eaten in ages and there's nothing they can do to get a meal today. That's your absolute bottom level. And in Australia, we've forgotten that that level even exists. Right, but it does. That is in fact the default state of mankind.
We need to be reminded, right? Now, in my opinion, none of us understand the level, the quality of living that we have, right? Now, if anyone, again, I've never been to Ethiopia.
Sure.
Right? But imagine if every single one of us got a free ticket for 1 week in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And go and live with them in the way they live. You'd have a lot more appreciation. Let me tell you, some people are going to laugh at this. Some people are going to say you're crazy. But when I was younger, right, I was told to eat everything on my plate or else I get a smack. That's just the way it is, right? Eat everything, right? You understand the value of a dollar and what that food means. Let me tell you, when my kids were growing up and they weren't eating, all I had to show them was a video of the starving kids in Ethiopia. Mm. And I did that.
Mm.
They eat everything on their plate.
Mm.
That is a reminder of what it can be like. And this is the thing with us, right? It's serious stuff here. It's true. Like, it's gluttony here. You're very, very right in regards to how rich we all are. But we are creating monsters of ourselves, and our expectations are just more and more and more. And in my opinion, it is because we sit here every day comparing ourselves to people that have more than us, not comparing ourselves to people that have less than us. What we need to start doing is comparing ourselves to people that have less than us so we can become more grateful, right? I think about these things a lot now, right? Like I'm chasing the next property deal, the next business. How can I extract more money from here? And I'm just like, when does it stop? My wife asked me, when does it stop? Why? Because I am comparing myself to people with more, to people with private planes, to people with mansions, to people with this. But what I'm not comparing myself is to the people with less.
But this is what I was saying to James before the podcast as well. And you know, a part of me doesn't even want to say it because I know it'll probably piss some people off. But that's my if there's a criticism that I have with these March for Australias and Tommy Robinson marches and things like that is, and God bless all the people that are going that need change and need help. There was some, you know, heart-tugging stories of people that Adam spoke to, right? Mm. But let's just say 80% of the people that are going think that by going, they're doing something to help better their state and the state of you know, everybody else around them. But really, it's like, it's you go to this march and it makes you feel like you're doing something, but it all starts at home. It all starts within. It all starts with perception. It all starts with gratitude for where we do actually live and saying, okay, this is where I'm at. This is where I'm at compared to the last 200,000 years of human history. What can I do about it to support me and my family and my loved ones? Mm. Who can I speak with? Who can I associate with? Rather than getting revved up and riled up by, you know, the speaker of the day, whoever it is. It's like, we're out here, we've got a microphone, but I do think we need to do more to be able to, you know, talk about painting the picture and the perception of things. And
can I speak to your point? Because I think we need to have a much bigger conversation differentiating between consumption and production. Mm-hmm. So in a single sentence there, you talked about chasing the next property deal and having a private jet. Those are in fact opposite things. One is productive, the other is consumptive. Now, there are certain people where getting a private jet increases their production in a meaningful way, and that actually becomes productive. But for most, it's a vanity thing, of course, right? The problem with Australia is not that we consume too much. It's that we currently consume more than we create. That's the only problem. We can consume as much as we want. Honestly, the future wealth of humanity is simply our production minus our consumption. That's all it is. Whatever the difference is has been added to the wealth that we have now. Now, there's atrophy over time, things decay over time, so there's a certain amount needed just to maintain where we are. If we produce above that, if the leftovers after our consumption is larger than that atrophy, that decay that happens over time, then we've made the world a richer place.
I'd love for you to take us through a step-by-step, and you might have touched on it last episode, but I think it's important because I think these are the issues that we really should be talking about. Mm. Step-by-step, what Australia needs to do as a country to be more productive.
Okay. 100% the problem is overregulation. Right now, 27% of GDP is, the government spending is 27% of GDP, up from 24% when Albanese was elected. So as an increase, that's a 10% relative increase in what we're spending on government. Now, that only counts actual government jobs. What that doesn't count is how much of the private sector's time and money and productive capacity is wasted satisfying the government. Every government job kills you in three ways. Firstly, it has to get paid out of taxes, which is money taken from someone who is productive who no longer gets to spend that money on something productive. So it's killed you once. Secondly, that's a person who could have worked a productive job who is no longer working a productive job, they're working a consumptive job. Why is it a consumptive job? Because of the third thing that they do, which is they write rules and regulations and reports and demand that people who could otherwise be productive now have to waste time filling out forms, filling out reports, doing compliance, getting studies or reports done. I mean, the amount of reports you'd have to get done on any property development, from Indigenous impact surveys to environmental stuff to this and that, right? Just there. So every single government job is costing us three times more than you think. Mm. So if the government is 27% of GDP, this is why our standard of living is going down, because our entire productive capacity, nearly 100%, sort of 85% of our productive capacity is gone. Mm. And we're left with 15%, and it's just not enough because of the decay of time. Why are we in a per capita recession? Why is our standard of living going down by more than 10 years? In just the last 3 years, our standard of living has gone back to 2012 levels. That's 15 years of standard of living loss.
Only Western country in the world that's been that bad?
Fastest. Not only. Okay. That's been that bad. Yes, that's a valid statement. Yes, but it's the fastest. It's not the only one that's declined, but it's by far the fastest. Mm-hmm. And when you understand that multiplication, you realize that every single time we allow the government to get even a little bit bigger, it is going to have a disproportionately large impact on our standard of living. Now, I talked last time about that gap, the ratio between what an employee costs their employer's purchasing power versus the purchasing power they get. And for those that didn't see that, the fact is you're left with about 40% of what you cost your employer, but then your employer and every employer has to set their prices according to that maximum value. So with that 40%, you're trying to pay for a cost of living that is priced to recover the 100%. And that's why you're chasing your tail. Mm. That gap is government, right? So that metric that I said, this is the number one thing, this is the most important thing. The size of government is just a different way of expressing that same gap. When we're at 27%, we are allowing the government, with that multiple of three, because they're sucking taxes to pay for themselves, then we've lost a productive person out of productive capacity, and then they're wasting everybody else's time because that's their job, is to make everybody else run around and satisfy them in their unproductive capacity. we multiply the size of government by three, we've got a government that is eating about 85% of our potential in this country.
And like, we're doing a property development at the moment, right? And you look at the compliance, that's why James and I, as soon as you said, I looked at each other, I'm like, just because the compliance side to it is massive.
Mm-hmm.
But I said this on multiple podcasts, raise the prices, do what you want, increase the compliance. It's all built into the end price.
Yeah.
Right. There's line items for this on a feasibility, on a profit and loss statement. There's line items. So whatever it is, it doesn't matter because that gets divided out by a certain margin that needs to be created.
Yeah.
So you can get funded to do a job.
Yep.
And the sale price is the sale price at the end.
And then we say, why can't young families afford a home to live in? That's why.
And it is becoming more and more of a problem.
Mm.
Never mind in property development, in business now, right? Like the compliance.
Mm.
And this leads me into this economic reform.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Which I seen on one of your podcasts.
Great video.
That you talked as
Thank you.
You mentioned it as a tax fest.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, more compliance on top. Mm-hmm. I've been following this guy. He's an Australian guy. I forget his name. Cameron, I think. Something Cameron or Cameron something. And he's a family, a business guy, family man, just moved to Bali. And all his videos are around the reason why he moved and how much taxes are being paid in Australia and that he's three times better off on the same income.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not earning any more and he's three times better off in Bali at the moment. So what are your thoughts on this economic reform and some of these taxes? Because I know a lot of it is, well, I hope a lot of it is propaganda, but at the end of the day, it's like you said before, it happens slowly. Right? The seed gets planted, and all of a sudden, 5 years later, 10 years later, it's normalized.
Yeah. And that tax talk, that tax fest is a great example of that. So we had a thought bubble that came out of a think tank around taxing bedrooms and it got heaps of headlines.
Oh, wow.
And I went, so this is taxing excess bedrooms, taxing vacant bedrooms. Because the argument goes, and this is classic ivory tower paperwork thinking. The argument goes, well, we've got all these people. They're using one or two bedrooms out of these four bedroom homes that have been built. Well, if they just had to have people in those bedrooms, then the housing crisis would be solved. You know, forget private property, forget personal security. You know, now you've got to let other people into your home, all this sort of stuff. Forget just the fact that you own it because you paid for it. Forget all of that. There's spare bedrooms. Now, one of the points that I made was that the reason why we build four-bedroom homes is for the same reason that we build five-seat cars, even though most of the time there's only one person driving, because the cost of building a car is not directly proportional to the number of seats you stick in the damn thing, right? The cost of building a car is 90% other stuff and 10% how many people you wanted to fit inside it. It's the same with a house. Adding on another bedroom adds an enormous amount of value to the sale price of the house, but actually from a construction point of view, well, there's minimal wiring, there's no plumbing, just a bit of, you know, flooring and walls and roof and you're done.
That's why they build no more one bedrooms in the country, because the cost of building a one bedroom apartment versus a two bedroom apartment is not much more.
Correct.
The sale price is
astronomically higher. And so to demonize the consequence of the cost of construction, which is a government caused phenomenon anyway, and to demonize people for having spare bedrooms, when you can't buy a house that doesn't have spare bedrooms, you know, if you're a couple, and you know, no kids or retirees or what have you. Secondly, let people have their bedrooms. My grandparents had a six bedroom house that they grew old in and ultimately retired out of into sort of care. The family would get together twice a year and they had lots of kids. So all my cousins would be there. Those bedrooms would be stuffed to the gills for maybe 4 weeks a year, but they're empty for the rest of the time. Let's demonize them. No, they paid for that. They worked for it. That's what they decided to run their family. And it was beautiful. But that was one of the suggestions. And my alarm bells rang. My antenna went up when I saw the amount of press that it got. I went, this doesn't feel right to me. Why? Why does this not feel right to me? And I realized this was the opening gambit. This was the anchor, the normalization statement that was designed to get us fearful so that we would accept and be grateful for the less bad thing.
Yeah,
that's what I said.
That's still bad. But it would be the less, and I put out a video saying exactly this. I said, this bedroom tax is an enormous amount of noise. It's getting SBS and ABC and all sorts of other coverage.
It also rallies the haves versus the have-nots.
And it anchors that divide. This is an anchoring statement. There is something else coming that they plan to ram through. Well, sure enough, out of the tax fest, the Prime Minister comes out, oh, that wasn't us. We didn't talk about the bedroom tax. That was just a thought bubble. That's, you know, that's right-wing media. It was the ABC trying to whip up a fear campaign.
Paid by the government.
But what we are going to do is a cash flow tax. Mm. Did you guys come across this one?
I knew from your video. Oh, I sent it to the boys.
This is the one that I think he will actually attempt. So in addition to the unrealized gains tax, I think the cash flow tax is the one that he's actually going to try and push through. So what this does is they're saying, oh, we're going to reduce company profits tax, right? And we're going to introduce a 5% cash flow tax, which is literally cash in for any reason minus cash out for any reason. If there's a difference in that number, we tax you 5% of that number over the period. Super, super simple, right? Thing is, the reason why they say that that's a good idea is because it will encourage investment. It will encourage businesses to spend because essentially you get an instant asset write-off on that 5% tax. Now, we're going to get a little bit wonky into tax policy here. So some of you are going to love it. Some of you are going to hate it. That's essentially, it's an instant asset write-off for the cash flow tax. If you spend an extra $10,000 on something, well, that takes it out of the cash flow tax. And that's their argument. It's going to be good for investment. It's going to incentivize companies to spend. Well, hold up. We already have a thing called an instant asset write-off on company tax that you could just tweak the rules of, and it doesn't require any new reporting. It doesn't require the tax office to get expanded to administrate yet another. We have over 100 taxes in this country, by the way. Only about 10 of them raise much money, but we have over 100, and every single one of them comes with compliance overhead on the business side, on the taxpayer's side, and also overhead on the government side. And these become largely unproductive jobs. It's been acknowledged that actually more than 50 of our taxes cost more money than they raise. That's been acknowledged, but they won't get rid of them. So obviously the solution is to add a new tax, right? That's what you do. When you've got 100 taxes already and 50 of them are losing you money, the obvious thing that you do as the government is you add another tax. So even the rationale for this tax makes no sense. It would be far more sensible for them to tweak the instant asset write-off if they want to encourage investment, if they want to encourage spending. What this is GST 2.0. When they brought in the GST, they said, we're going to abolish property taxes and stamp duties, and we're going to abolish all these other taxes. So they got the vote, and they said, right, we're bringing the GST. By the way, we've changed our mind. We're not abolishing all of those. So they're saying, we're going to bring in this cash flow tax, but it's not going to cost you anything. We're going to reduce corporate profits tax a commensurate amount. They win the argument, they get elected again, or they push this through the parliament. I guarantee you, even if they do reduce corporate tax for a little while, it won't be for long, right? This is all going to go up again.
Yeah. So do you largely agree with the premise that credit needs to expand, and then that there's two kind of ways to tackle the issue? There's the way that the Trump administration is coming in trying to do it. They're trying to grow their way out of the problem by reducing tax, making the country more productive. And then there's a tax your way out of the problem.
Let me reply with a nuclear option. The government should not issue currency at all. Currency should be an entirely private thing. It used to be.
Is crypto sending it there?
Crypto is a return to private currency, to private equity. So anyone can create money. You guys are in business. You understand this. The minute you extend credit to one of your suppliers, the minute you have an IOU. Now, this used to happen quite often. So the argument in favor of the fiat system is we need to be able to expand credit. And if we have it tied to gold, then obviously we can't do that. And sometimes you need to do that, right? Mm-hmm. Well, historically, if you had a new town pop up in the middle of nowhere, gold rush was happening, something like that, someone rocks up and starts a general store and pots and pans and sacks of flour and all the rest of it. And people start coming in saying, look, I can't afford to pay you right now, but I'll bring in some gold, you know, I'm working on whatever, okay? The store starts to issue IOUs or you owe me's or, you know, whichever way it may go. And it's got the store stamp on it. And for as long as people have faith in the store, that's currency. What happens very quickly is people start trading the IOUs, right? And they've just literally issued money out of a local corner shop, effectively. Everyone can issue money. What it comes down to is confidence. And this is why governments say, well, the government needs to issue our money and we have to have legal tender because people can have faith in it. Yeah, and then the governments go bankrupt and people's faith was very clearly misplaced. The expansion of credit and whether it expands, whether it contracts, etc., the last people we want to trust with such an important function is politicians and bureaucrats. Let the market sort it out. And for me, it would just simply be a case of so there is a requirement in Australia, every business has to accept Australian fiat currency. That's a legal requirement. If you operate in Australia, you must accept Australian dollars. I would love to see a deregulation that removes any restrictions around accepting other currencies as well. I'm not deep into this policy area, so I don't know what restrictions there are or are not. And technology-wise, it's becoming increasingly possible. There are platforms now where already, you know, things like Wise, etc., will work across multiple fiat currencies seamlessly. And I'm in conversation with an Australian group that are actually developing one where they can work across the crypto space and the fiat space. They're already registered with they've got their Australian banking license, and they've got a relationship with Visa. So you would literally be able to walk in and essentially pay with a tap card. And as far as the merchant is concerned, they've received whatever dollars. As far as you're concerned, you've just spent out of your Satoshis or whatever. I mean, you'd be an idiot to spend Satoshis at the moment, but you've spent whatever you've spent, right? And all of that is handled seamlessly by the payment gateways. We're entering an era where private money is actually making a comeback in the form of crypto. And I think a lot of these macroeconomic arguments are actually built around the fallacy that this is the government's job to begin with.
Yeah, and that's the big point is, and I think you articulated it so perfectly when you said, for every government job that's created here, that costs you three times.
Yeah.
When government puts money into existence, that's the only path, right? Whereas when a business is creating credit, they have to be productive.
There has to be value.
If they don't bring in revenue and create value and employ people and create jobs, they go out of business. Mm-hmm. Whereas the government doesn't have that. They're not able to go out of business because they are the law. Yeah.
And governments believe that them printing money doesn't hurt anybody. And the question then becomes,
and all of this is a distraction for the fact that it is very harmful.
Yeah. And the question then becomes, why do we have taxes at all? If printing money is fine, why not just print all the money that you need to run the government? Yeah. Why do we have taxes at all?
What? I don't think taxes are going away anytime soon.
Unfortunately.
I think about that as well.
Yeah.
If you could just print money, why isn't just everybody?
For the sake of clarity, I'm not saying that's a good idea. That's a terrible idea. Yeah. I'm just pointing out the logical absurdity.
Yeah, correct. Now, what are your thoughts on skilled workers, entrepreneurs, getting fed up and leaving the country at some point with taxes? Like, we've got friends, acquaintances that have done this. There's more and more people doing it. There's more and more people posting about it. Do you think this is something that's just a spasm, like you mentioned before, and something else? Or is this something that you think is going to be more and more in demand? Because it's like, hey, like, I'll be honest with you, that guy that's been posting a lot going, hey, my life's three times better off without learning one more dollar, and I'm in Bali now. Of course, you know, the level of lifestyle in Bali is probably a little bit different than Australia, and the safety and the rest of it. So it's there's never one for
one. It's cross-cultural, and you've got to be willing to and the kind of person that can enjoy that culture.
Correct. But what I'm trying to get at is, we've got skillful people, right? Very, very smart people. Like, I've got 3-4 friends, right? A couple of them are friends of mutual friends of ours here. I mean, Adam is one of them.
Yeah.
Right. Very, very smart guy. Very intelligent. A lot, you know, Australia is a lot better off with having a guy like that here.
Correct.
And not having him here. And he's not here.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? Is that going to continue, Mark? Right.
You mentioned this last time when I don't think a lot of people were talking about it, the second passport.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it used to be, you know, have gold, land, but now it's become have gold, Bitcoin, and the second passport in communities. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Jurisdictional competition is one of the greatest changes that is happening in our world right now. Technology has made it possible for you to select jurisdictions. And I want to give a huge shout out to Andrew Henderson, Nomad Capitalist. I think
Adam was
there. I wanted to be there. Unfortunately, I couldn't make it this year, but I hope to be there in future. He's not the OG, but in terms of the mass public awareness of these ideas, Andrew Henderson, Nomad Capitalist, is one of the best. The idea of spreading your risk across jurisdictions and the technology to do that is now very, very real. It used to be that you had to have all of your things in one basket because you didn't have the ability to have a bank account in another country and a business registered in another country and investments and assets in another country. Now it is possible. You can do all of that. We'll come back to that in a minute. If you're playing the drinking game, make sure you've charged your glass because you need to talk about Venezuela. So your question is, you know, is this just a spasm? The thing that completely changed my perspective, I was a go down with the ship, I will fight for Australia until the bitter end kind of guy, until I went to Venezuela. Specifically, we were in a jazz bar, and this is the shocking thing, and when I talked about how normal it felt, Venezuela was once a tremendously rich country. even up until actually the late 90s, was still a relatively, it was doing okay. But you rewind 120 years to around the time Australia was one of the wealthiest per capita countries on earth. Argentina was as well. Oh, sorry, Venezuela was as well at that time. They had the rubber boom. They had precious metals. The oil boom had just sort of happened and they've got a lot of oil. They were a tremendously wealthy country and the architecture shows it and the culture shows it. To this day, you can get Michelin-hatted restaurant food there if you have an enormous amount of money. The music culture, fabulous, so good. And so we're sitting in what felt like a Melbourne basement whiskey bar, live jazz music being played at a phenomenal standard. I mean, really top notch. Great atmosphere. The drinks were cheap. That helped the atmosphere as well. And, you know, my theory was if you can get a cocktail for $1.70, you're saving like $20 every time you buy a cocktail. So if you just buy a few thousand of those while you're there, then you've actually made money on the trip. You know, that was my theory.
Spend to save.
Yeah, that's right. And so we're sitting there and I got chatting with an old guy. We were in booths with these low backs and there was an old Venezuelan guy in the next booth. And I said hello and we got chatting and he spoke enough English that we could communicate pretty well. And he figured out pretty quickly that I wasn't a socialist because there's a really clear divide in that country. And he began to tell me his story. And he shared with me how he was politically active in the 90s and he tried to stop Hugo Chavez from getting into power in Venezuela. And he campaigned and he attended the protests and he handed out, you know, material, he stuffed letterboxes, did all the things that we would do here in this country. And he said they weren't successful and Hugo Chavez was elected. And a whole bunch of his friends left Venezuela and he was so angry at them. Why are you leaving? We need to stay and fight. We got to say exactly all the stuff that I felt about Australia. And he said, I realized now that you can't save a sinking ship if everyone else on board that ship is smashing bigger holes in the bottom. Mm-hmm. And he said, I gave everything. I did everything except for look after my family and make sure that my family were going to be okay if the ship, the good ship Venezuela sank. And I sat there and I'll never forget his face because I know what it looks like on a man's face who was presumably in his 70s or perhaps late 60s to carry the weight of his grandson's malnutrition, right? And he's talking to me about how his grandson has the pot belly that you see mm-hmm. in the ads about Ethiopian kids mm-hmm. that comes from malnutrition. Mm-hmm. Talking about how his son lost his business. He was in IT, he lost his business, and he's now basically an alcoholic and living in perpetual depression. Because, you know, you can't buy flour or eggs or butter, but you can get alcohol. Yeah, you can certainly get a lot of that. And to see in his face this level of failure as a man at the deepest, deepest level. As a man with a wife and kids, protecting and providing for them is everything. And there are men who work themselves to death to pay the bills, to look after the wife so that she can have something nice so the kids can get school. They will skip medical appointments. They will put aside their dreams. Men will sacrifice their lives one miserable day at a time. And we all know what that weight feels like. This man knew that he had failed to do that. And there's nothing, I sat there, I'm like, what do I say? I'm like, there's nothing I can say. Mm. There's nothing I can say to this man that's going to lift that burden and that knowledge off his shoulders. So all I did in that moment was I sat there and I went, I will never be him. I will never be that man. I will never carry that weight. And my face will never have that look on it. And that changed everything with regard to my view about going down with Good Ship Australia. And I am now an advocate. I've been very public about this. Get that second passport. Get yourself structured offshore. If you have the option of earning your income online, then have a think about whether Australia is the right place for you to be. If you're stuck where your income is geographically dependent, have a think about how you can change that.
Where to save that money? What currency, what asset to be saving
and
that money?
And on that point, I go back to Andrew Henderson and his flag planting theory. Andrew's put out a huge number of videos and people often don't know where to start. Just go Nomad Capitalist, five flag theory. Start there. And he talks about dividing your life into five different domains. There's where you have your bank accounts, where you live, where you have your structures, where you have your investments and passports, where you have passports. And they don't all have to be the same place. this is the thing. We live in a world where no longer do you have to put all of your eggs in one basket.
I've got my second passport. The only issue is it's a Canadian one.
Double fucked.
Yeah. I'll get you one better. I've got an English one. I mean, it used to be European as well, but it's fucked as
mine's well. Italian, so I've got Giorgio Meloni.
Yeah, it's not so bad.
What keeps you up at night, Dover?
Very little these days. George Carlin, the comedian, had a wonderful explanation for how he became such a seminal comedian. And, you know, his comedy was social observation. And he wasn't actually standing up trying to be funny. He was just standing up telling you the truth about what was happening in the world at the time, making astute political and social observations. And I disagree with his theology. I disagree with lots about him. But he was a wonderful observer and expresser. And he simply made the point that you've just got to disconnect from the outcome. You've just got to disconnect and just realize you can't save the world. The world's going to do whatever the world's going to do. Now, so I've George Carlin'd myself, but I've done it from a Christian perspective, which sounds like a contradiction because he was a famously atheist. I've come to realize, and I'm going to speak from a Christian perspective, if that upsets you, so be it. I've come to realize that the outcome is above my pay grade. God has called me to be faithful to do the thing that I'm supposed to do. He hasn't said that I'm definitely going to get a specific result. If God wanted a specific result, God could have it instantly. He does not need your or my involvement in anything. The journey is the point. We sit there and go, but God, I'm not seeing the result. It's not the point. The point is the journey and the faithfulness and the actions that you are undergoing and what that's doing in you and in your relationship with God. That is the point. If God just wanted the outcome, he would already have it. So the outcome's out of my hands. The outcome doesn't actually matter. It's not my responsibility. My responsibility is, did I do today the thing that I've been called to do? Was I faithful with the day that I was given to do with it the thing that I've been called to do with my days? And that's to be a father, to be a husband, and it would seem to be a spokesperson, to be someone who helps others to make sense of the nonsense. That seems to be my thing, right? Was I faithful to that? Okay, good night, sleep soundly, get up at 6 o'clock tomorrow and do it again. That's it. I sleep really well at night.
I want to say well done. I'm sure the boys want to say the same thing because that's why I'll always come on when Topher's on the pod because, you have views, you have beliefs, but the way that you're able to articulate the conversation, not trying to encourage people to take a certain course of action, but just to try and awaken them to things on a grand scale, I think you do so well. And you know the world needs more people who can speak as well as you can. And
We're getting a lot of different people wanting to come on the pod. We're having a lot of discussions. We've got a group chat, right, with our booker going, okay, who do you want on? Who should I reach out to?
Yeah.
You know, there's inflow traffic. And we're being very strategic with who we bring on. And someone like yourself, anyone out of those, you know, 700 plus comments from the initial podcast, we knew we'd have you on again. And we will have you on again and again and again. Because things change over time.
Sure.
And what happens in 5 months, there's a lot that
it's a lot that's happened, yeah.
And there's a lot that happens in 5 months. And you can see, like Mark just said, you know, the intelligence you can articulate. And I don't feel like it's, you know, this one-way debate, right? And like you said that earlier about Charlie Kirk, you know, there was two microphones every time with that guy. Mm-hmm. And he didn't just sit there and preach one way.
Yeah.
He always gave the opportunity to the other person to say, let me hear your side of the story.
Yeah.
You can hear my side of the story. And he was really good at saying my side of the story is probably makes more sense than yours.
Yeah.
So really, really appreciate you coming on. And I want to end it with one last question because I think right now there's a lot of Australians, not just Australians, a lot of people in the Western world that got their head in the sand, right? And we all live by hope. And there's a lot of hope that's diminishing for a lot of people and people are giving up on hopes and dreams. What is the one truth Australians don't want to face right now, in your opinion?
Very simple. The government is not the solution. It is the problem. That's it. The government is not the solution. It is the problem. The problem with Australians, as was famously said by someone whose name will come to me in a minute, is not that they are descended from the convicts, but it's that so many are descended from the jailers, right? I think I may have given you that quote last time as well. And the jailers are about rules and regulations and dobbing in and controlling others. And that instinct is very deep with Australia today. And it meets its expression in essentially the worship of government. The government has become a de facto god. God is not dead in this country. We've turned the government into God. And until Australians realize that going to the government and saying, hey, you need to do something about this, is the problem will continue to get worse.
Powerful. A lot of truth in the, hey, this is serious stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
this is real. This is real talk because the thing is you can only make the decision yourself, right? Like you have someone like Adam,
mm-hmm.
right? Who everyone from the outside in would have thought, man, this guy's got the house on the beach. He's got the Ferrari in the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
He's traveling. And he sold everything. Mm-hmm. Like, it gives me anxiety still today thinking about it because my wife and I are always talking about different things, right? And one of these things right now is where do we go if we're not here? Because we love the Gold Coast specifically. And these are serious conversations. And I'm still, go ahead, Ryan.
No, is the anxiety from having to sell all those things or the belief that it actually could be better?
Yeah, I think anxiety comes from making the wrong choice. And but you said it earlier is I'm trying to think about the outcome, not the journey.
Mm-hmm.
So the outcome of me going, yeah, let me sell everything. And in 10 years time, go, holy shit, that was a bad decision because and probably the fear of the judgment of being wrong. Right. Especially now because we're vocal. Right, like we got a microphone. We got a bit of a
doorbell.
Yeah, and there's a portion of me that wants to do that from time to time, and I have nowhere near the following of a lot of people.
Sure, can I respond to that?
Yeah,
have a little faith in yourself.
Yeah,
do you really believe that it would take you 10 years to then go, oh, my life is a smoking crater of a hole?
Yeah, no,
before you pivot.
Yeah, definitely.
And do you really believe that if it was the wrong decision, that you wouldn't then figure out how to make the best of it?
I appreciate that, and it would definitely not be. But again, I think this is there's that portion of scarcity. There's that portion of, you know, what society tells you that I think is ingrained in a lot of us still.
Yeah.
As much as we believe certain things, and I guess to end it here is just, where does everyone listening to this sit, right? Like look in the mirror and know what you need to work on, because I need to work on those things, right? Like I battle with myself every day. Do I sell this? Do I not sell this? Do I, you know, do I invest in this? Do I not invest in this? Do I not go to work today and just spend the time with the kids because of school holidays, because you're not going to get that time back? All these things, right? But Mark,
it's the question that Eric Thomas, when he's talking and he's doing those speaking events, he says, are you willing to give up everything that you are for everything that you want to become?
Yeah.
Right. And I think that is why it's so difficult today, because you do have to give up a part of yourself, especially if a part of yourself has been someone who's loved the Australian culture and going to the footy and all the things that we do love in this country to be what you want to become.
I think in someone like such as Eric's position, also you're in a fairly fortunate spot, self-created, is that you don't have to rip the whole bandit off in one go. You can kind of go experience it, try and put the toe in and go walk back. All right, cool. We'll flip it all and go.
Yeah.
But it's just the fear in general, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's just, and that's why I take my hat off and why I mentioned Adam, and I've mentioned him a couple times, not just because he's a bank and he's a business partner and the rest of it, but let me tell you what he's done.
Ballsy.
Right? Not many, like you're talking 0.00000 of a percent that somebody would actually do.
And yet the numbers of people that are doing it, particularly out of the UK, it's very striking. So many millionaires.
They're going to lose 16,000, 160,000 millionaires or 16,000 millionaires? I heard it on Doak.
I think I saw 16,000.
I have a friend right now, ex-business partner, very good friend, I'm the godfather to his daughter, overseas right now, looking at schools, looking at equestrian centers, looking, and he pays millions of dollars in tax.
Mm-hmm.
He's when I talk about skilled workers, when I talk about entrepreneurs, he's one of them
that
will not be here.
Eric, I think.
And it's sad. You want to know why it's sad? It's sad because selfishly, it's a mate that I'm not going to be able to go and hang with on a Friday, on, or, hey, let's go to dinner because he won't be here.
Yeah.
The beauty of it is it'll force me to go, you know what, holy shit, maybe I should be doing the same.
Yeah. I think that it's important to look at the reason that you want to leave as well.
Yeah.
Because if the reason is just to save on tax.
It's not a good enough
reason. Right. It's not a good enough. It's not a good enough reason.
Yeah.
And to that point, like, Eric, you could live a fantastic life from what you've set up now, regardless of where you live. So it would have to be.
I mean, I feel like I'm living a fantastic life now.
Yeah.
But I think it's just a lot of, and again, it's probably too a lot what you listen to and who you surround yourself with, because 5 years ago, 6 years ago, this wasn't even a discussion. This wasn't even a topic.
Yeah, yeah.
This wasn't even in the realm of my world talking about these topics. It was just make money, pay tax, buy things.
Can travel, I come back, you know, to, what I mean? Like, to the attitude that Andrew Henderson has? And I'm sorry to keep bringing him up, but he really is a great touchstone for this. His whole philosophy is go where you're treated best. Now, what we're expressing is that in Australia, we are still treated tolerably. There's lots of things that we would love to be different, but let's be honest, Australia's awesome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's amazing.
The problem is the trajectory that I see without a significant cultural shift, and I think we are in a significant cultural shift right now. Will that come to Australia? Will that be enough? I don't know. The jury's out on that. But the world is changing, and maybe we'll be okay. But as things change, will you reach the point where you will recognize that you are no longer willing to tolerate how you're being treated? And the question is, what's the lag on that? Because this guy in Venezuela, his friends had a very short lag. Socialism has taken over this country. We're getting out because we know that we're not going to be treated tolerably very soon. He had a long lag. I'm going to keep fighting for it. Other people had a lag because they didn't notice it. Mm. Most people are living in a world that stopped existing 20 years ago. Mm. Our perception of where we are, you talk to most Australians and get them to describe Australia, they're describing the 1990s or the early 2000s. They're not describing the country we live in today. So are you happy with the way you're being treated now? Are you even aware of it, really? Are you happy? Which direction is it going in? And is there somewhere else where you go, you know what, I'm going to get treated better?
It comes back to your point when you said a lot of people out there consider government the God.
The solution, yeah.
And even if they don't consider government the God, the lack of, let's not get on into a debate about religion and whether it's good or bad, but the lack of religious belief means that they're starting to worship their false deities, like the green movements,
yep,
and all these.
Gaia.
So if you're worshiping the green movement, or you're backing the LGBTQ, yep, movement, or whatever, sure, we can argue that these are good movements, but that's a proxy. That's a government proxy, yep, of worshiping the government God.
Yeah. Because there is an argument to be made that there is no true atheist. There is no one that doesn't believe in God. There are, at the closest thing you can ever get to an atheist is someone who believes that it's them. That's
yeah. Yeah.
Topher, thank you so much for coming. Know you're a busy guy, obviously a lot of growth in what you're doing. Again, congratulations on 100,000. Obviously it's 111,000 I checked this morning. So growing rapidly, keep doing what you're doing, spreading the word. James, Mark, thank you very much. I know you guys were excited for this one. So. Mark, even wore a Satoshi shirt today for those of you guys that are just listening. I actually thought it was a Nirvana shirt at first. It's definitely a Satoshi shirt. And again, guys, just like, subscribe, share, comment, let us know what you like. We had 700 comments, over 700 comments, 50,000 views, organic views on the last one. Let's try and beat it on this one, and we'll see you on the next one. Thanks.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.